It's my privilege, my honor to welcome Mark Antaki from the University of McGill today to our Short Conversations with Legal Thinkers series. Mark, would you like to say a few words as a way of introduction? Can you tell a little bit about yourself?
Sure. If we were at McGill, so we're connecting virtually across a big distance, but if we were here and it would be a first day of classes, I'd likely start off with the land acknowledgement and have a conversation with the students about that. So our university's land acknowledgement reads as follows. McGill University is situated on the traditional territory of the Kanien Kehaka, a place which has long served as a site of meeting and exchange among nations. We recognize and respect the Kanien Kehaka as the traditional custodians of the lands and waters on which we meet today. So I guess you asked me to introduce myself. And so one of the things I would probably say about myself is being a colonizer and thinking about that identity in relation to my research and my teaching and my responsibility for speaking law.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about your experience as a teacher of jurisprudence. So my class is conventionally entitled Jurisprudence and Critical Approaches to Law. Do you have a particular term that you like? Do you like to refer to it as jurisprudence, legal theory? And also, how would you characterize your own approach to jurisprudence, legal theory, and so on?
My tendency is to inherit course names. Like, I rarely get to name my own class. I don't know if you got to name your own course or if that's what it's like already.
It was an inheritance, indeed.
Yeah. So I'm inheriting a lot of courses, and I'm inheriting the course titles. And my tendency is to just look at the course title and kind of think through the words of the title and then see whether and how I can kind of project myself into that. So if I hear jurisprudence and I hear prudence and jus, and then prudence makes me think of phronesis. And then I wonder, like, what's the kind of history of that, the use of that title in law faculties or in universities. So I don't know what I would choose myself yet. I didn't really get to that place, though I have a feeling for the different courses we have at McGill, and I have a kind of vague sense of the history behind that course. Who taught it first or earliest, and what tended to be taught, and how has that been received over time? So even if jurisprudence, you can do a lot of kind of work with it, in some circles it might really resonate in a very Oxford-centric way. Jurisprudence mm-hmm. might be Hart, Raz, and Dworkin, and a very specific set of authors. And even if you could use that word in a different way, you might be pulled in the kind of gravitational direction of those authors. Whereas critical approaches to law, I'm guessing very few people would list those authors in that part of the course. So jurisprudence and critical approaches to law almost reads like kind of a traditional way of asking what is law in law faculties, and then a different or new or other ways that are less kind of usual.
How would you yourself characterize your own approach then to the field? If you were to define the course, given the chance of giving it your own title and naming it, how would you characterize your perspective to law?
It's a really good question and a difficult one. I think that I would probably head in the direction of using a word like legality, what makes law law, and kind of like exploring our preconceptions about legality, about what makes law mm-hmm. law. And so we all have mm-hmm. things we've decided in advance, preconceptions that are tied with kind of habits that we have in advance, predispositions. And I guess I'd want to find a title that would point to preconceptions, predispositions, and how what we already bring to the table, so to speak, has already answered the question of what makes law law for us. So I would really want it to be something about predispositions or preconceptions, mm-hmm. I think. That would be my tendency. My sense is that many students, I'm teaching theoretical approaches to law this year to the master's students at McGill, so I emailed all of them because of the context to ask about time zones and things like that. And I asked them, well, why don't you tell me what you think theory is, or why a course such as this would be mandatory in a program? And most of them said theory was kind of a set of principles that kind of explained or rationally kind of captured the way the law is. So it's like to stand on top of something and master it was the way I think many of us tend to think of theory. And I would want to kind of turn that on its head and to say, no, it's like, it's rather, it's undoing things, making things harder to master, like making us wonder about, well, how come, rather than it being about, now I understand this, I've solved this problem.
I like how you describe this thinking before thinking, or you've mentioned perhaps the idea of genealogy and history being important, undoing, unlearning. Is there certain particular school of thought or certain particular author who has influenced your own work?
Yeah, and there's also some kind of aphorisms or specific quotes that I really like, even if I'm not always very familiar with the whole of the author's work. If there's one author in particular who has influenced me, it's probably, I mean, now obviously we change as scholars and over time, but early on it was probably Heidegger, by way of my supervisor, Philippe Nonet at Berkeley. And there are some specific aphorisms that I really like that I try to kind of remember. So one of them is from Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals, which is something like, only that which has no history can be defined. And now we know from being law students or teachers of law, the rise of the definition section in a statute. We have a legislature who says, this means this, this means this, this means this in this world that I'm creating. And we see that in some kind of legal theory texts as well, where there are some authors who say, by this word, I mean this, by this, I mean that, to kind of define things. And my tendency is to be suspicious of that kind of way of proceeding, that even if we want to define a word in a certain way, we're borrowing it from a whole kind of history of interruptions and of changes over time. So that's one quote I really like that I try to remember, even though I'm not what you would call a professional historian by any stretch of the imagination. I also like a couple of quotes from Wittgenstein. One of them is that ethics and aesthetics are one and the same, which I think captures a lot of how I'm trying to think things through, that we tend to separate these two things. I remember when I got to grad school at Berkeley to do my doctorate, I was in a very different place than I am now intellectually, and I saw the courses that were being offered. And there was a course on Aristotle's ethics. And I was like, great, this is awesome. This is exactly what I want to do. I want to think about ethics. I want to think about what is the right thing to do. And there was another course called Law in the Work of Art, something like that. And I was like, I don't want to do that. That's about art and aesthetics. And I'm not interested in that stuff. And it turned out the same person, my future supervisor, was teaching both of them. And I realized how quickly I was kind of being really limited in having decided everything in advance about what I was interested in, about what was relevant, about what was connected. And so for me, all of these kinds of classes are all about identifying what we've decided in advance and allowing ourselves to question what we've already decided in advance. And another quote I really like also from Wittgenstein, which James Boyd White uses, I think, quite a bit, if I remember correctly, is a quote about the relation between language games and forms of life. So I guess in terms of influences, that's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're teaching a legal theory course now in McGill. That being said, what do you think is the role of jurisprudence in a law faculty such as McGill?
That's a good question. So when I'm teaching theoretical approaches to law at McGill, it's for the master's students. And half of them have thesis projects and half of them have non-thesis writing projects. And so as a graduate student, I think when you think of theory, it's hard to not think about, well, what's my project? What am I writing? And so one thing that often comes up in that class is the relation between so-called theory and method. Right? What is a theoretical reflection and what is my reflection on my method, my methodology, and how are the two related to each other? So if theory is about my habits of attention, which is what do I notice, what do I not notice, then method is about what I do. And so what's the relation between what I notice and what I don't notice and what I do. And I think that takes on a different kind of significance for a master's or a doctoral student who has a huge writing project. At the level of the law degree, even though, for example, at McGill, there's a writing requirement, it's not as significant as a thesis. And the writing requirement doesn't weigh on the students the moment they're enrolled in the law faculty. So when I'm teaching the class, the students know I have another 2-3 years before I can satisfy this writing requirement. And the writing requirement, I'm not told I need to have a theoretical approach the way graduate students are. And so it feels like the foundations or jurisprudence class is just more abstract. But for a graduate student, it's not. It's tied to what I do. And I think it's the same is the case for the law students, that these classes are basically classes about, in Hannah Arendt's words, thinking what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And that can have repercussions in all kinds of different ways or different contexts. Oftentimes, it's easy for us to be more reflexive about our hobbies than about the things we kind of have to do. But I think the idea that is to kind of channel that reflexivity that people have in their day-to-day life and kind of remind them that, you know, learning something in a mandatory class is not that different from a hobby.
Mm-hmm. That's what we aspire to, indeed. You've mentioned a little bit the class of legal foundations, and I wanted to ask you about the particular bidural or trans-systemic education at McGill University, and how has that shaped your own understanding of law, your own approach to teaching?
Right. So I was educated, I did my law degrees at McGill under the old so-called national program. So I had a year of mostly civil law courses, then a year of mostly common law courses, and then a mix of the two. And so I was taught in a kind of single tradition way. Every class was tied to one tradition. And then there was the reform to the so-called integrated or trans-systemic program, where you're learning different legal traditions in the same class. And now the challenge is to not limit oneself to the civil law and to the common law, but to take indigenous legal traditions seriously and as much as possible on their own terms while trying to teach them. So how does that affect something like foundations? The first question I would assume that it and how it would affect us is foundations of what? So it used to be called foundations of Canadian law, then it kind of was shortened, you know, to foundations of law, and now like the shorthand is foundations. And Rod MacDonald has a whole article that in a way kind of reminds one of the changing kind of unofficial title of the course. So it's not foundations of the common law, it's not foundations of the civil law. So what are we talking about when we're talking about foundations? And so I think for me, the bidural or trans-systemic thing, the first thing it does is it kind of doesn't give you a home. It doesn't give you a place where you can kind of be at rest and say, well, this is who I am, this is where I am. And if I don't want to, I don't have to venture forth. I can be comfortable in this place and not wonder, not ask questions, not have to encounter people who talk differently, who think differently, who live in the world differently than I do. So this idea of a kind of enforced homelessness, which can be scary, but it also means that we're kind of strangers to ourselves. So we have to kind of re-encounter ourselves constantly. So again, I think that would go back. And the other thing I think it does is the idea that you want to maybe make certain implicit things explicit. That if you're only learning one tradition, so to speak, a lot of the learning might be kind of just picking things up from your prof or from this, or from the sources or whatever. Just there's a way of doing things that I'm learning. And so I don't necessarily need to make all of it explicit. And so there might be a call to make certain things kind of more explicit or to call them out because we're teaching different ways of doing things at once.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift gears a little bit. You've mentioned you taking a course on Aristotle ethics in your graduate program. And now I know that you do teach a course on Plato's Republic, but I want to ask you about the challenges, or how do you face the task of bringing the text to life in the context of the 21st century, and how do you pedagogically think of getting across that divide, that historical divide?
Right. At McGill, I don't sell the course, but I kind of invite students to it as a kind of trans-systemic course. At mm-hmm. McGill, you're mm-hmm. learning the civil law, you're learning the common law, you're doing things in English, you're doing things in French. Well, now we're going to do a few things in Greek. And it's a different mm-hmm. translation exercise. And it's a translation exercise also to a different way of speaking and living law, where you don't have professional jurists or lawyers the same way we do. Where you don't necessarily experience the division between law and politics the way we do. And yet we draw so many of our key words from Greek. So it's kind of a trans-systemic course where you kind of invite people to speak in a way they're not used to and to talk about law in a way that they may not be used to. So for instance, in our language, in both English and French, I think today we're quite wedded to speaking about subjective versus objective. We do that with regard to standards of care and criminal law and tort law and things like that. Is it subjective or objective? And the students have a tendency to want to speak that way when they're reading Plato. And I'm like, oh, you can't do that. That's not how you would have made it. You have to speak Greek to do this. How would you frame this in Greek? And it would be something like, well, the way things are in themselves or the way they appear or appear to me. You can't say subjective and objective. And so I think those are challenges that are similar to learning across languages, whether it's English and French, or as you know, many indigenous scholars are reminding us of, that so much is going on in languages that already explains how we might think of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this ties perfectly with my next question, which has to do precisely about the importance of language in your work, and you use a term that might not be familiar to our viewers, but the idea of keywords, and I wanted to ask about the importance of language in your work, but also perhaps a related question is on the importance of the imagination for you. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. When I was a law student at McGill, I was working as a research assistant for Rod McDonald. And he was working on an article with another RA of his, Martha Marie Kleinhans, who's now mm-hmm. a law professor as well. And we were having conversations, and there were all these words being thrown around: subject, agent, person, human being. And I was like, I don't understand. Like, what's the difference between a subject, a person, and an agent, and a human being? And like, how? And then I think Martha Marie had written these circles, like overlapping concentrics. This is the bigger category. This is a smaller category. And I still didn't get anything. I still didn't quite understand. And then I got to Berkeley. And my supervisor, Philippe Nonet, who basically thought of Greek and Latin as remedial English, or called them kind of remedial English, all of a sudden I started listening to words. Words were no longer variables, X and Y, right? X means this, Y means that. All of a sudden the words themselves could kind of tell you something. Subject, subiacere, thrown under, right? And all, person, personare, to sound through. And then all of a sudden I started listening to words and they started to come alive. And I felt a little bit kind of less lost. I kind of felt like I could start to be a little bit more at home, that I could kind of just listen to language or listen to words, and that they could tell me something, instead of being kind of overly kind of like, this is the big category, this is a little category. Maybe that works, but it works because of the etymology of the word or the history of the word. So for me, it was a way of kind of learning to listen and to be open to the kind of the sonority and to the etymology of words. The phrase keyword I got from Raymond Williams, who wrote a book of key words. And so for me, it's always been about taking shorthand and translating shorthand into a keyword. So a word that we rely on day after day after day after day, but we don't really stop to think about how we're using it. How do we take that shorthand and then turn it into a keyword? So instead of being the kind of throwaway word, we kind of like dwell on it and we think about it for a long time. So I published a piece on the rise of values talk in constitutional law, And values is one of those words that is just, for me, a big shorthand in today's world. We just use values without thinking that it's only been since the 19th century that people kind of talk the way we do with that word. And before that, there's no way anyone would have used the word values in the plural, except maybe to speak about the values of, you know, land in this neighborhood, or the values of current, electrical current, or things like that. But values in the plural to talk about kind of ethical matters or what is good or my values, that is so recent, and it's even more recent in law, and yet it's taken for granted today, right? But there's no way, for example, that Plato would have talked about my values. It would have been the good, right? Or something like that, but not my values. So there's a world of difference. If you're reading the Republic or talking to someone from another tradition, and it's like, well, my values are this, what are yours? If you're presuming that everyone has values, you've already decided quite a bit in advance. So for me, the idea was to, by way of language, take things we kind of take for granted and then slow down and try to unpack them and not presume that everyone speaks the way we do. And I think for me, another thing about language was that, how to put it, so much is going on there. We think we're in control of our thoughts sometimes, or in control of what we want to say, but we're not. We find ourselves using certain words. We all have verbal tics. We all have favorite expressions. And if you kind of attend to your actual go-to words rather than the ones you think are your go-to words, a world might open up for you. So we're all asked as scholars to put keywords in articles, right? But those keywords are the ones I chose, or an editor chose with me, in light of what I think I'm doing in the article. But they're not necessarily the words I actually rely on the most, that reveal the most about my way of thinking. Those might be completely different. And so if we kind of attend to the words we find ourselves using, then we could learn a lot about ourselves. Mm-hmm. So part of why I was drawn to the word imagination, well, the initial reason was I was struck by and impressed by and learned a lot from James Boyd White's work. And he, you know, titles a book, The Legal Imagination, which has been such a massively important book in law and literature and in law and the humanities more generally. And then I started noticing other people using the word imagination, people like Dworkin, people like Unger, people like Santos, I think, just different people using the word imagination. And I was like, well, what's going on? Why are people using this word to talk about law, or to talk about what it is to do law or to practice law? And so for me, I guess what I was ended up being drawn to is imagination as a kind of third faculty or third way that would put less emphasis on reason understood somehow in isolation, or will understood somehow in isolation. So it's almost as if in a traditional jurisprudence class, and I'm going to really simplify right now, but you might have legal positivism on the one hand, and, you know, Austin might be a figure of positivism and law is command, and then Hart comes along and wants to rectify that. But law is basically tied to will, to the imposition of a way of doing things by someone on someone else. And then you might have, then some people would call it natural law or whatever, and against utter simplification, but then law is not about will, it's about reason. And yet imagination comes along and it's like a third word, it's a third key word. What if his law is not essentially about will, nor is it essentially about reason, but it's essentially about imagination? And that's quite tied to what goes by the name, I think, of, you know, a cultural study of law or law and the humanities today, is that we're interested in habits of attention, habits of framing, habits of perception, not just what is rational or reasonable, or, you know, what has been decided by the empowered body. And so I thought that was quite interesting. And at first I was just trying to figure out, why are people going to imagination? And then the second thing that it kind of taught me, or that I wondered about, was there, since Max Weber, there's been talk of a kind of disenchantment of the world. There's a rise of a kind of instrumental reason, or a kind of a technicity in the way we inhabit the world or do law or whatever, right? And so I thought, well, what if people are using the word imagination because they want to make things kind of enchanted or magical again, which doesn't happen with just reason or just will? What if that explains some of the turn to imagination. And for me, part of why imagination, because I think one of the most pressing questions today, both theoretically and practically, so to speak, is the question, the way Jean-Luc Nancy might put it, is how to share a world. How do we share? How do we share a world? How can we be with one another? And it's a question that keeps coming up when I teach, whether it's theoretical approaches or foundations. And it's almost as if, well, on the one hand, we share a world as kind of rational beings, but then we don't really share a world because it's this weird disembedded absolute reason that doesn't really exist that somehow binds us together, or else it's kind of force or violence. And then imagination would presumably be a kind of answer. And I think that's why James Boyd White probably turns to it so much, as a kind of answer to the problem of community. How do we say we? Can there be a we? And I don't think the answer is kind of reason understood in a very narrow sense, nor kind of will. So I think there are practical implications of that term there. And another really practical implication is most law students today, I'm guessing in Canada, maybe I'm wrong, are still being taught mostly by way of appellate cases. And most, I think, I mean, there might be like a litigation classes where you do read trial judgments. I don't know. But then we're reading stuff that's based on the law being more and more separated or purified from the facts. So the problem of perception isn't necessarily that important in most. So it's just kind of law purified from facts, purified from how we perceive things. And yet I think imagination would bring you back to the problem of perception, and it might make facts, you know, that much more important in relation to the law. Mm-hmm. Imagination invites us to pay attention to how we pay attention.
Yeah, I like very much how you connect the idea of imagination with the idea of re-enchantment of a world which has been disenchanted in a way through Max Weber's diagnosis of modernity. You are now touching upon my next question, which is on international law or the area of human rights and transitional justice that you've been writing about. What are the main challenges or the main thrust of your ideas in international law, in constitutional law, transitional justice?
I think one of the challenges is how so many kind of narratives of newness or separation are actually narratives of reproduction. So I'm turning the page on this. So we're leaving this behind and now we're going there. And so there are all these kind of metaphors or images about getting from A to B, where, you know, are we really leaving A behind? Or are we reproducing it in B? So I think that's, you know, are true transitions possible? And so I think that's important, not only kind of on the ground politically, for example, in the South African context or in the Canadian context as well, but also in terms of how we speak about transitions. That's where I became interested in kind of images like the bridge or the book, images of transition that are used, for example, or were used in South Africa's interim constitution. So opening a new chapter in a book, or this constitution is a bridge between that older order and this order. And I started just kind of being interested in, well, why and how these images, and if it's a book, what kind of book? And should we not kind of not just assume that all books are the same, but what kind of book? And that's where I got into learning about different ways in which historians and literary theorists and others were saying, well, here's a connection between this specific type of book and this way of doing or thinking about human rights. So Lynn Hunt, for example, argued in Inventing Human Rights that the epistolary novel, where you kind of have an exchange of letters and you get into someone else's head, so to speak. Well, she thinks, so that taught people empathy and it taught people to learn about others who were not of their gender, their class, their upbringing, and so on. And so there's a kind of a democratization and empathy that happened in that way. But then you have someone like Joe Slaughter who will say, well, I'm going to think about the Bildungsroman and human rights. And there I'm going to speak about how, in a way, the the end is already there in the beginning. And so you have a different genre that leads you to have a different potential take on human rights. And I think that I found that quite kind of useful in thinking and teaching and talking to students, to think about, well, it's not just that you have a story or you have a set of rules. It's like, well, what kind of story or what, right? And I think that is really important. And we know this, you know, from being moviegoers, TV watchers. So if someone's used to situation comedy of a certain era and you want to translate that into drama, well, how would you switch it up? And like, well, what if those switches are really relevant to so-called legal or, mm-hmm. or quasi-legal documents, right? So it got me thinking about, I don't know the history of calls to action, but we have calls mm-hmm. to action in Canada. Well, what is a call to action? Since when do we speak that way? Is it a genre? Is the commission riffing off of something that's existing that we need to learn more about? And so all of a sudden, it's not just the content of the calls to action that matters, but the very way in which they're kind of presented and labeled.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to thank you very much for talking with us, for talking to our class, but for having this conversation, and hopefully we will continue having these conversations in the near future.
Well, thank you for having me. And if any of the students in your class who are listening want to reach out and ask me something, they should feel free to do so, or just to share a reaction or a thought they had with me. I would appreciate it.
That's for sure. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you.